Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
The first complete dinosaur skeleton was found in southern England in 1858. The bones belonged to a creature called Solidosaurus. The early British paleontologist Richard Owen incompletely described its body in papers that were published in 1861 and 1863. But for years, scientists did not pay much attention to Solidosaurus. That has now changed. Scientists have recently finished several careful studies of the dinosaur's remains. The findings suggest the creature had an unusual build. University of Cambridge paleontologist David Norman recently published his fourth study on the Solidosaurus. It appeared in the Zoological Journal of the Linnaean Society of London. Norman wrote that this animal was discovered at a crucial time in the history of dinosaur research. He added that until the discovery, dinosaurs had only been known from scraps of bone and some teeth. Solidosaurus lived about 193 million years ago. It was an early member of the evolutionary family that led to the dinosaur group called ankylosaurs. Ankylosaurs were armored dinosaurs. Their bodies were so strong that they are sometimes called the tank dinosaurs. Solidosaurus was about 4 meters long. It had 4 legs and 8 plants. It was covered in bony plates with hard, pointy spikes. The one that died near what is now West Dorset, England, was probably the victim of a flood. It probably drowned in the sea, with its body becoming buried in sand and dirt. I'm John Russell.
September 7th is Labor Day in the United States. The national holiday began more than 100 years ago to honor low-paid factory workers. Labor Day unofficially marks the end of summer. In any other year, students would be getting ready to go back to school. Many Americans would celebrate the day with an outdoor barbecue with family and friends. Others would use the long weekend to take their last vacation of the summer, before hot days turn cooler. But 2020 is not any other year. Students in many parts of the country will be going back to school online for all or part of the autumn term. Health officials in several states are advising against social gatherings ahead of the holiday weekend. And travel, especially air travel, has been down sharply all summer. Health officials have reason to be worried. Several parts of the country saw increases in COVID-19 cases following the other 2 major holidays this summer, Memorial Day and Independence Day. The increases in many places were linked to family gatherings. Labor Day started with a struggle. On May 1, 1889, workers demonstrated on the streets of Paris, France. International Labor Day was born. Most industrialized countries in the world, except the United States and Canada, celebrate Labor Day on the 1st of May. The first American Labor Day celebration was held on September 5, 1882, in New York City. About 10,000 workers marched through the streets to show the strength of labor organizations. For many years after that, American workers used the first Monday in September to demand better working conditions and pay. Music was a part of many of those marches. Labor songs traditionally tell stories of conflict and hopes for a better life. Here is Pete Seeger's We Shall Not Be Moved. Many classic American labor songs came from workers in the coal mines of the South. Mine owners bitterly opposed workers' unions. In Kentucky, company police searched for union leaders. They waited outside a worker's home for several days to block him from organizing. The coal miner's wife, Florence Reese, stayed inside with her children. She wrote this song, Which Side Are You On? Here is Natalie Merchant singing the song.
How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
Another American labor song is called Bread and Roses. It is based on a poem by James Oppenheim, published in December of 1911. The poem speaks about the women's labor movement. At that time, conditions in factories, where many women worked, were horrible. A fire at a clothing factory in New York killed 146 people. Most of the victims were immigrant women. A month after Oppenheim's poem was published, textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts, went on strike. Their protest won them higher pay and better working conditions. Oppenheim's poem gained more attention. Here is Judy Collins singing Bread and Roses. Even though Labor Day demonstrations are not as common in the U.S. today, the song reminds us to celebrate the effort and love that many people give to their work.
A new study has found that ozone pollutants in Earth's lower atmosphere increased across the northern hemisphere over the past 20 years. Ozone is a form of oxygen. In Earth's upper atmosphere, it acts as a barrier to block harmful radiation from the sun. But closer to Earth's surface, ozone is a common pollutant. At ground level, high levels of ozone can harm people's lungs and damage plants. a European research program called the In-Service Aircraft for a Global Observing System collected the data. The program equips commercial aircraft with instruments to measure atmospheric conditions during flight. The study, published recently in Science Advances, is the first to use information from passenger planes. The Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences carried out the research. It is a partnership of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the University of Colorado Boulder. The researchers used ozone observations from more than 60,000 flights worldwide. The scientists centered on five areas of the Northern Hemisphere: the northeastern United States, Germany, India, Southeast Asia, and Northeast China and Korea. The study found that overall, ozone levels in most parts of Earth's atmosphere increased in the Northern Hemisphere during the past 20 years. The researchers did, however, report lower ground-level ozone in some areas, including North America and Europe. But they said those results were canceled out by increases in ozone higher up in the atmosphere. Audrey Gottel was the lead writer of the study. She is a Ceres scientist working in NOAA's Chemical Sciences Laboratory. The results are, in her words, a big deal because it means that as we try to limit our pollution locally, it might not work as well as we thought. Gottel said the data collected by international aircraft was very valuable in creating a clear picture of ozone levels over the Northern Hemisphere over long periods. Other methods of long-term data collection have produced conflicting ozone results. She noted that between 1994 and 2016, commercial aircraft planes had captured nearly 35,000 ozone profiles. The research team used the data to estimate changes in lower atmospheric ozone from the mid-1990s to 2016. On average, ozone values increased about 5% every 10 years. To explore what was causing the changes, the scientists examined levels of nitrogen oxides, a mixture of gases made up of nitrogen and oxygen. Nitrogen oxides are considered to be atmospheric pollutants often resulting from human activities. The researchers used the aircraft data to create models to estimate how nitrogen oxide releases affected atmospheric conditions. They said results suggested that increased releases in the tropics, the area close to the equator, were likely driving the observed increase of ozone in the Northern Hemisphere. The team said it found some of the sharpest increases in areas where ozone levels were once the lowest. These included Malaysia and Indonesia, as well as other parts of Southeast Asia and India. Those areas had very low ozone values between 1994 and 2004, but very high levels in recent years, between 2011 and 2016.
I'm Brian Lynn. Thank you.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. But they were not. One was a secretary of state who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a secretary of the treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a secretary of war who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Furling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Furling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented, and the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.